Washington. Take this easy-to-use heuristic, which is, to repeat the definition, a simple compressed rule of thumb, to detect the independence and robustness of someone's reputation. With few exceptions, those who dress outrageously are robust or even anti-fragile in reputation. Those clean-shaven types who dress in suits and ties are fragile to information about them. Large corporations and governments do not seem to understand this rebound power of information and its ability to control those who try to control it. When you hear a corporation or a debt-laden government trying to reinstill confidence, you know they are fragile, hence doomed. Information is merciless. One press conference to tranquilize, and the investors will run away, causing a death spiral or a run on the bank. Which explains why I have an obsessive stance against government indebtedness as a staunch proponent of what is called fiscal conservatism. When you don't have debt, you don't care about your reputation in economic circles, and somehow it is only when you don't care about your reputation that you tend to have a good one. Just as in matters of seduction, people lend the most to those who need them the least. And we are blind to this anti-fragility of information in even more domains. If I physically beat up a rival in an ancestral environment, I injure him, weaken him, perhaps eliminate him forever, and get some exercise in the process. If I use the mob to put a contract on his head, he is gone. But if I stage a barrage of informational attacks on websites and in journals, I may be just helping him and hurting myself. So I end this section with a thought. It is quite perplexing that those from whom we have benefited the most aren't those who have tried to help us, say, with advice, but rather those who have actively tried, but eventually failed, to harm us. Next, we turn to a central distinction between the things that like stress and other things that don't. Chapter 3. The Difference Between the Organic and the Engineered. The Cat and the Washing Machine. Stress is knowledge, and knowledge is stress. The organic and the mechanical. No translator needed for now. Waking up the animal in us after 200 years of modernity. The bold conjecture made here is that everything that has life in it is to some extent anti-fragile, but not the reverse. It looks like the secret of life is anti-fragility. Typically, the natural, the biological, is both anti-fragile and fragile, depending on the source and the range of variation. A human body can benefit from stressors to get stronger, but only to a point. For instance, your bones will get denser when episodic stress is applied to them, a mechanism formalized under the name Wolff's Law after an 1892 article by a German surgeon. But a dish, a car, an inanimate object will not. These may be robust, but cannot be intrinsically anti-fragile. Inanimate, that is, non-living material, typically, when subjected to stress, either undergoes material fatigue or breaks. One of the rare exceptions I've seen is in the report of a 2011 experiment by Brent Carey, a graduate student, in which he shows that composite material of carbon nanotubes, arranged in a certain manner, produces a self-strengthening response previously unseen in synthetic materials, similar to the localized self-strengthening that occurs in biological structures. This crosses the boundary between the living and the inanimate, as it can lead to the development of adaptable load-bearing material. We can use the distinction as a marker between living and non-living. The fact that the artificial needs to be anti-fragile for us to be able to use it as tissue is quite a telling difference between the biological and the synthetic. Your house, your food processor, and your computer desk eventually wear down and don't self-repair. They may look better with age, when artisanal, just as your jeans will look more fashionable with use, but eventually time will catch up with them, and the hardest material will end up looking like Roman ruins. Your jeans may look improved and more fashionable when worn out, but their material did not get stronger, nor do they self-repair. But think of a material that would make them stronger, self-heal, and improve with time. Another way to see it. Machines are harmed by low-level stressors, material fatigue. Organisms are harmed by the absence of low-level stressors, hormesis. True, while humans self-repair, they eventually wear out, hopefully leaving their genes, books, or some other information behind, another discussion. But the phenomenon of aging is misunderstood, largely fraught with mental biases and logical flaws. We observe old people and see them age, so we associate aging with their loss of muscle mass, bone weakness, loss of mental function, taste for Frank Sinatra music, and similar degenerative effects. But these failures to self-repair come largely from maladjustment, either too few stressors or too little time for recovery between them. And maladjustment, for this author, is the mismatch between one's design and the structure of the randomness of the environment, what I call more technically its distributional or statistical properties. What we observe in aging is a combination of maladjustment and senescence, and it appears that the two are separable. Senescence might not be avoidable and should not be avoided. It would contradict the logic of life, as we will see in the next chapter. Maladjustment is avoidable. Much of aging comes from a misunderstanding of the effect of comfort, a disease of civilization. Make life longer and longer while people are more and more sick. In a natural environment, people die without aging, or after a very short period of aging. For instance, some markers, such as blood pressure, that tend to worsen over time for moderns, do not change over the life of hunter-gatherers until the very end. And this artificial aging comes from stifling internal antifragility. The complex. This organic, mechanical dichotomy is a good starter distinction to build intuitions about the difference between two kinds of phenomena, but we can do better. Many things such as society, economic activities and markets, and cultural behavior are apparently man-made, but grow on their own to reach some kind of self-organization. They may not be strictly biological, but they resemble the biological in that, in a way, they multiply and replicate. Think of rumors, ideas, technologies, and businesses. They are closer to the cat than to the washing machine, but tend to be mistaken for washing machines. Accordingly, we can generalize our distinction beyond the biological, non-biological. More effective is the distinction between non-complex and complex systems. Artificial, man-made mechanical and engineering contraptions with simple responses are complicated, but not complex, as they don't have interdependencies. You push a button, say, a light switch, and get an exact response, with no possible ambiguity in the consequences, even in Russia. But with complex systems, interdependencies are severe. You need to think in terms of ecology. If you remove a specific animal, you disrupt a food chain. Its predators will starve and its prey will grow unchecked, causing complications and series of cascading side effects. Lions are exterminated by the Canaanites, Phoenicians, Romans, and later inhabitants of Mount Lebanon, leading to the proliferation of goats who crave tree roots, contributing to the deforestation of mountain areas, consequences that were hard to see ahead of time. Likewise, if you shut down a bank in New York, it will cause ripple effects from Iceland to Mongolia. In the complex world, the notion of cause itself is suspect. It is either nearly impossible to detect or not really defined. Another reason to ignore newspapers with their constant supply of causes for things. Stressors are information. Now, the crux of complex systems, those with interacting parts, is that they convey information to these component parts through stressors, or thanks to these stressors. Your body gets information about the environment not through your logical apparatus, your intelligence and ability to reason, compute, and calculate, but through stress, via hormones or other messengers we haven't discovered yet. As we saw, your bones will get stronger when subjected to gravity, say, after your short employment with a piano moving company. They will become weaker after you spend the next Christmas vacation in a space station with zero gravity, or, as few people realize, if you spend a lot of time riding a bicycle. The skin on the palms of your hands will get calloused if you spend a summer on a Soviet-style cooperative farm. Your skin lightens in the winter and tans in the summer, especially if you have Mediterranean origins, less so if you are of Irish or African descent, or from other places with more uniform weather throughout the year. Further, errors and their consequences are information, For small children, pain is the only risk management information, as their logical faculties are not very developed. For complex systems are, well, all about information. And there are many more conveyors of information around us than meet the eye. This is what we call causal opacity. It is hard to see the arrow from cause to consequence, making much of conventional methods of analysis, in addition to standard logic, inapplicable. As I said, the predictability of specific events is low, and it is such opacity that makes it low. Not only that, but because of non-linearities, one needs higher visibility than with regular systems. Instead, what we have is opacity. Let us consider bones again. I have a thing for bones, and the idea I will discuss next made me focus on lifting heavy objects rather than using gym machines. This obsession with the skeleton got started when I found a paper published in the journal Nature in 2003 by Gerard Carcenti and colleagues. The tradition has been to think that aging causes bone weakness. Bones lose density, become more brittle, as if there was a one-way relationship, possibly brought about by hormones. Females start experiencing osteoporosis after menopause. It turns out, as shown by Carcenti and others who have since embarked on the line of research, that the reverse is also largely true. Loss of bone density and degradation of health of the bones also causes aging, diabetes, and for males, loss of fertility and sexual function. We just cannot isolate any causal relationship in a complex system. Further, the story of the bones and the associated misunderstanding of interconnectedness illustrates how lack of stress, here bones under a weight-bearing load, can cause aging, and how depriving stress-hungry anti-fragile systems of stressors brings a great deal of fragility, which we will transport to political systems in Book 2. Lenny's exercise method, the one I watched and tried to imitate in the last chapter, seemed to be as much about stressing and strengthening the bones as it was about strengthening the muscles. He didn't know much about the mechanism, but had discovered, heuristically, that weight-bearing did something to his system. Ladies in traditional societies in India, Africa, and the Americas have outstanding health and excellent posture, thanks to a lifetime of head-loading water jugs. There is even a Levantine love song about an attractive woman with an amphora on her head. The health benefits could beat bone density medication, but such form of therapy would not benefit pharma's bottom line. Our antifragilities have conditions. The frequency of stressors matters a bit. Humans tend to do better with acute than chronic stressors, particularly when the former are followed by ample time for recovery, which allows the stressors to do their jobs as messengers. For instance, having an intense emotional shock from seeing a snake coming out of my keyboard or a vampire entering my room, followed by a period of soothing safety, with chamomile tea and Baroque music, long enough for me to regain control of my emotions, would be beneficial for my health, provided, of course, that I managed to overcome the snake or vampire after an arduous, hopefully heroic fight and have a picture taken next to the dead predator. Such a stressor would be certainly better than the mild but continuous stress of a boss, mortgage, tax problems, guilt over procrastinating with one's tax return, exam pressures, chores, emails to answer, forms to complete, daily commutes, things that make you feel trapped in life. In other words, the pressures brought about by civilization. In fact, neurobiologists show that the former type of stressor is necessary, the second harmful for one's health. For an idea of how harmful a low-level stressor without recovery can be, consider the so-called Chinese water torture, a drop continuously hitting the same spot on your head, never letting you recover. Indeed, the way Heracles managed to control Hydra was by cauterizing the wounds on the stumps of the heads that he had just severed. He thus prevented the regrowth of the heads and the exercise of anti-fragility. In other words, he disrupted the recovery. Table 2 shows the difference between the two types. Note that there may be intermediate steps between engineered and organic, though things tend to cluster in one bucket or the other. Table 2, the mechanical and the organic, biological or non-biological. The mechanical, non-complex, needs continuous repair and maintenance. The organic, complex, is self-healing. The mechanical hates randomness. The organic loves randomness, small variations. The mechanical has no need for recovery. The organic needs recovery between stressors. The mechanical has no or little interdependence. The organic has a high degree of interdependence. In the mechanical, stressors cause material fatigue. In the organic, absence of stressors causes atrophy. The mechanical ages with use, wear and tear. The organic ages with disuse. The mechanical undercompensates from shocks. The organic overcompensates from shocks. In the mechanical, time brings only senescence. In the organic, time brings aging and senescence. Frano Barovic, reading this chapter, wrote to me, "Machines, use it and lose it. Organisms, use it or lose it." Also note that everything alive needs stressors, but not all machines need to be left alone, a point we will visit in our discussion of annealing. The listener can get a hint of the central problem we face with top-down tampering with political systems, or similar complex systems, the subject of Book 2. The fragilista mistakes the economy for a washing machine that needs monthly maintenance, or misconstrues the properties of your body for those of a compact disc player. Adam Smith himself made the analogy of the economy as a watch or a clock that, once set in motion, continues on its own. But I am certain that he did not quite think of matters in these terms, that he looked at the economy in terms of organisms but lacked a framework to express it. For Smith understood the opacity of complex systems as well as the interdependencies, since he developed the notion of the invisible hand. But, alas, unlike Adam Smith, Plato did not quite get it. Promoting the well-known metaphor of the ship of state, he likens a state to a naval vessel, which, of course, requires the monitoring of a captain. He ultimately argues that the only men fit to be captain of this ship are philosopher kings, benevolent men with absolute power who have access to the form of the good. And once in a while one hears shouts of, "Who is governing us?" as if the world needs someone to govern it. Equilibrium, not again. Social scientists use the word equilibrium to describe balance between opposing forces, say, supply and demand, so small disturbances or deviations in one direction, like those of a pendulum, would be countered with an adjustment in the opposite direction that would bring things back to stability. In short, this is thought to be the goal for an economy. Looking deeper into what these social scientists want us to get into, such a goal can be death. For the complexity theorist Stuart Kaufman uses the idea of equilibrium to separate the two different worlds of Table 2. For the non-organic, non-complex, say, an object on the table, equilibrium, as traditionally defined, happens in a state of inertia. So for something organic, equilibrium, in that sense, only happens with death. Consider an example used by Kaufman. In your bathtub, a vortex starts forming and will keep going after that. Such type of situation is permanently far from equilibrium, and it looks like organisms and dynamic systems exist in such a state. These are the so-called dissipative structures, after the works of the physicist Ilya Prigozhin, that have quite a different status from simple equilibrium structures. They are formed and maintained through the effect of exchange of energy and matter in permanent non-equilibrium conditions. For them, a state of normalcy requires a certain degree of volatility, randomness, the continuous swapping of information, and stress, which explains the harm they may be subjected to when deprived of volatility. Crimes against children. Not only are we averse to stressors and don't understand them, but we are committing crimes against life, the living, science, and wisdom for the sake of eliminating volatility and variation. I feel anger and frustration when I think that 1 in 10 Americans beyond the age of high school is on some kind of antidepressant, such as Prozac. Indeed, when you go through mood swings, you now have to justify why you are not on some medication. There may be a few good reasons to be on medication in severely pathological cases, but my mood, my sadness, my bouts of anxiety are a second source of intelligence, perhaps even the first source. I get mellow and lose physical energy when it rains, become more meditative, and tend to write more and more slowly then, with the raindrops hitting the window, what Verlaine called autumnal sobs, sanglot. Some days I enter poetic melancholic states, what the Portuguese call saudade, or the Turks huzun, from the Arabic word for sadness. Other days I am more aggressive, have more energy, and will write less, walk more, do other things, argue with researchers, answer emails, draw graphs on blackboards. Should I be turned into a vegetable or a happy imbecile? Had Prozac been available last century, Baudelaire's spleen, Edgar Allan Poe's moods, the poetry of Sylvia Plath, the lamentations of so many other poets, everything with a soul would have been silenced. If large pharmaceutical companies were able to eliminate the seasons, they would probably do so. For a profit, of course. There is another danger. In addition to harming children, we are harming society and our future. Measures that aim at reducing variability and swings in the lives of children are also reducing variability and differences within our said-to-be great culturally globalized society. Punished by translation. Another forgotten property of stressors is in language acquisition. I don't know anyone who ever learned to speak his mother tongue in a textbook, starting with grammar and, checked by bi-quarterly exams, systematically fitting words to the acquired rules. You pick up a language best thanks to situational difficulty, from error to error, when you need to communicate under more or less straining circumstances. Particularly to express urgent needs, say physical ones, such as those arising in the aftermath of dinner in a tropical location. One learns new words without making a nerd effort, but rather another type of effort, to communicate, mostly by being forced to read the mind of the other person, suspending one's fear of making mistakes. Success, wealth, and technology, alas, make this mode of acquisition much more difficult. A few years ago, when I was of no interest to anyone, foreign conference organizers did not assign to me the fawning travel assistant, fluent in Facebook English. So I used to be forced to fend for myself, hence picking up vocabulary by finger-pointing and trial and error, just as children do. No handheld devices, no dictionary, nothing. Now I am punished by privilege and comfort, and I can't resist comfort. The punishment is in the form of a person, fluent in English, greeting me by displaying my misspelled name at the airport. No stress, no ambiguity, and no exposure to Russian, Turkish, Croatian, or Polish outside of ugly and organized textbooks. What is worse, the person is unctuous. Obsequious verbosity is something rather painful under the condition of jet lag. Yet the best way to learn a language may be an episode of jail in a foreign country. My friend Chad Garcia improved his Russian thanks to an involuntary stay in the quarantine section of a hospital in Moscow for an imagined disease. It was a cunning brand of medical kidnapping, as during the mess after the end of the Soviet rule, hospitals were able to extort travelers with forced hospital stays unless they paid large sums of money to have their papers cleared. Chad, then barely fluent in the language, was forced to read Tolstoy in the original, and picked up quite a bit of vocabulary. Touristification. My friend Chad benefited from the kind of disorder that is less and less prevalent, thanks to the modern disease of touristification. This is my term for an aspect of modern life that treats humans as washing machines, with simplified mechanical responses, and a detailed user's manual. It is the systematic removal of uncertainty and randomness from things, trying to make matters highly predictable in their smallest details. All that for the sake of comfort, convenience, and efficiency. When a tourist is in relation to an adventurer or a flaneur, touristification is to life. It consists in converting activities, and not just travel, into the equivalent of a script like those followed by actors. We will see how touristification castrates systems and organisms that like uncertainty by sucking randomness out of them to the last drop, while providing them with the illusion of benefit. The guilty parties are the education system, planning the funding of teleological scientific research, the French baccalaureate, gym machines, etc., and the electronic calendar. But the worst touristification is the life we moderns have to lead in captivity, during our leisure hours. Friday night opera, scheduled parties, scheduled laughs. Again, golden jail. This goal-driven attitude hurts deeply inside my existential self. The secret thirst for chance. Which brings us to the existential aspect of randomness. If you are not a washing machine or a cuckoo clock, in other words, if you are alive, something deep in your soul likes a certain measure of randomness and disorder. There is a titillating feeling associated with randomness. We like the moderate and highly domesticated world of games, from spectator sports to having our breathing suspended between crapshoots during the next visit to Las Vegas. I myself, while writing these lines, try to avoid the tyranny of a precise and explicit plan, drawing from an opaque source inside me that gives me surprises. Writing is only worth it when it provides us with the tingling effect of adventure, which is why I enjoy the composition of books and dislike the straitjacket of the 750-word op-ed, which, even without the philistinism of the editor, bores me to tears. And remarkably, what the author is bored writing bores the reader. If I could predict what my day would exactly look like, I would feel a little bit dead. Further, this randomness is necessary for true life. Consider that all the wealth of the world can't buy a liquid more pleasurable than water after intense thirst. Few objects bring more thrill than a recovered wallet or laptop lost on a train. Further, in an ancestral habitat, we humans were prompted by natural stimuli, fear, hunger, desire, that made us work out and become fit for our environment. Consider how easy it is to find the energy to lift a car if a crying child is under it, or to run for your life if you see a wild animal crossing the street. Compare this to the heaviness of the obligation to visit the gym at the planned 6 p.m. and be bullied there by some personal trainer, unless, of course, you are under the imperative to look like a bodyguard. Also consider how easy it is to skip a meal when the randomness in the environment causes us to do so, because of lack of food, as compared to the discipline of sticking to some 18-day diet plan. There exist the kind of people for whom life is some kind of project. After talking to them, you stop feeling good for a few hours. Life starts tasting like food cooked without salt. I, a thrill-seeking human, have a bullshit detector that seems to match my boredom detector, as if it were equipped with a naturalistic filter, dullness aversion. Ancestral life had no homework, no boss, no civil servants, no academic grades, no conversation with the dean, no consultant with an MBA, no table of procedure, no application form, no trip to New Jersey, no grammatical stickler, no conversations with someone boring you. All life was random stimuli, and nothing, good or bad, ever felt like work. Dangerous, yes, but boring, never. Neither Rousseau nor Hobbes. True, life then was perhaps brutal and short, but it is a severe logical mistake to present a trade-off, to use unsavory aspects of early humanity as a necessary cost of avoiding modern tortures. There is no reason to not want advantages from both eras. Finally, an environment with variability, hence randomness, does not expose us to chronic stress injury, unlike human design systems. If you walk on uneven, not man-made terrain, no two steps will ever be identical. Compare that to the randomness-free gym machine offering the exact opposite, forcing you into endless repetitions of the very same movement. Much of modern life is preventable chronic stress injury. Next, let us examine a wrinkle of evolution, that great expert on anti-fragility. Chapter 4. The anti-fragility of the whole often depends on the fragility of the parts. Why death is a necessity for life. The benefits of errors for the collective. Why we need risk-takers. A few remarks about modernity missing the point. A salute to the entrepreneur and risk-taker. What kills me makes others stronger. Anti-fragility for one is fragility for someone else. Where we introduce the idea that we think too much, do very little. Fail for others to succeed. One day you may get a thank you note. Antifragility by Layers. This chapter is about error, evolution, and antifragility, with a hitch. It is largely about the errors of others. The antifragility of some comes necessarily at the expense of the fragility of others. In a system, the sacrifices of some units, fragile units, that is, or people, are often necessary for the well-being of other units or the whole. The fragility of every startup is necessary for the economy to be anti-fragile. And that's what makes, among other things, entrepreneurship work. The fragility of individual entrepreneurs and their necessarily high failure rate. So anti-fragility gets a bit more intricate and more interesting in the presence of layers and hierarchies. A natural organism is not a single, final unit. It is composed of subunits and itself may be the subunit of some larger collective. These subunits may be contending with each other. Take another business example. Restaurants are fragile. They compete with each other. But the collective of local restaurants is anti-fragile for that very reason. Had restaurants been individually robust, hence immortal, the overall business would be either stagnant or weak and would deliver nothing better than cafeteria food, and I mean Soviet-style cafeteria food. Further, it would be marred with systemic shortages with, once in a while, a complete crisis and government bailout. All that quality, stability, and reliability are owed to the fragility of the restaurant itself. So some parts on the inside of a system may be required to be fragile in order to make the system anti-fragile as a result. Or the organism itself might be fragile, but the information encoded in the genes reproducing it will be anti-fragile. The point is not trivial, as it is behind the logic of evolution. This applies equally to entrepreneurs and individual scientific researchers. Further, we mentioned sacrifice a few paragraphs ago. Sadly, the benefits of errors are often conferred on others, the collective, as if individuals were designed to make errors for the greater good, not their own. Alas, we tend to discuss mistakes without taking into consideration this layering and transfer of fragility. Evolution and unpredictability. I said that the notions of Mithridatization and hormesis were proto-antifragility, introductory concepts. They are even a bit naive, and we will need to refine, even transcend them, in order to look at a complex system as a whole. Hormesis is a metaphor. Antifragility is a phenomenon. Primo, Mithridatization and hormesis are just very weak forms of antifragility, with limited gains from volatility, accident, or harm, and a certain reversal of the protective or beneficial effect beyond a certain dosage. Hormesis likes only a little bit of disorder, or rather, needs a little bit of it. They are mostly interesting insofar as their deprivation is harmful, something we don't get intuitively. Our minds cannot easily understand the complicated responses. We think linearly, and these dose-dependent responses are non-linear. Our linear minds do not like nuances and reduce the information to the binary harmful or helpful. Secundo, and that's the central weakness. They see the organism from the outside and consider it as a whole, a single unit, when things can be a bit more nuanced. There is a different, stronger variety of antifragility linked to evolution that is beyond hormesis, actually very different from hormesis. It is even its opposite. It can be described as hormesis, getting stronger under harm, if we look from the outside, not from the inside. This other variety of antifragility is evolutionary and operates at the informational level. Genes are information. Unlike with hormesis, the unit does not get stronger in response to stress. It dies. But it accomplishes a transfer of benefits. Other units survive, and those that survive have attributes that improve the collective of units, leading to modifications commonly assigned the vague term evolution in textbooks and in the New York Times Tuesday Science section. So the antifragility of concern here is not so much that of the organisms, inherently weak, but rather that of their genetic code, which can survive them. The code doesn't really care about the welfare of the unit itself. Quite the contrary, since it destroys many things around it. Robert Trivers figured out the presence of competition between gene and organism in his idea of the selfish gene. In fact, the most interesting aspect of evolution is that it only works because of its anti-fragility. It is in love with stressors, randomness, uncertainty, and disorder. While individual organisms are relatively fragile, the gene pool takes advantage of shocks to enhance its fitness. So from this, we can see that there is a tension between nature and individual organisms. Everything alive or organic in nature has a finite life and dies eventually. Even Methuselah lived less than 1,000 years. But it usually dies after reproducing offspring with a genetic code in one way or another different from that of the parents, with their information modified. Methuselah's genetic information is still present in Damascus, Jerusalem, and, of course, Brooklyn, New York. Nature does not find its members very helpful after their reproductive abilities are depleted, except perhaps special situations in which animals live in groups, such as the need for grandmothers in the human and elephant domains to assist others in preparing offspring to take charge. Nature prefers to let the game continue at the informational level, the genetic code, so organisms need to die for nature to be anti-fragile. Nature is opportunistic, ruthless, and selfish. Consider as a thought experiment the situation of an immortal organism, one that is built without an expiration date. To survive, it would need to be completely fit for all possible random events that can take place in the environment, all future random events. By some nasty property, a random event is, well, random. It does not advertise its arrival ahead of time, allowing the organism to prepare and make adjustments to sustain shocks. For an immortal organism, pre-adaptation for all such events would be a necessity. When a random event happens, it is already too late to react, so the organism should be prepared to withstand the shock or say goodbye. We saw that our bodies overshoot a bit in response to stressors, but this remains highly insufficient. They still can't see the future. They can prepare for the next war, but not win it. Post-event adaptation, no matter how fast, would always be a bit late. To satisfy the conditions for such immortality, the organisms need to predict the future with perfection. Near perfection is not enough. But by letting the organisms go one lifespan at a time, with modifications between successive generations, nature does not need to predict future conditions beyond the extremely vague idea of which direction things should be heading. Actually, even a vague direction is not necessary. Every random event will bring its own antidote in the form of ecological variation. It is as if nature changed itself at every step and modified its strategy every instant. Consider this in terms of economic and institutional life. If nature ran the economy, it would not continuously bail out its living members to make them live forever, nor would it have permanent administrations and forecasting departments that try to outsmart the future. It would not let the scam artists of the United States Office of Management and Budget make such mistakes of epistemic arrogance. If one looks at history as a complex system similar to nature, then, like nature, it won't let a single empire dominate the planet forever. Even if every superpower from the Babylonians to the Egyptians to the Persians to the Romans to modern America has believed in the permanence of its domination and managed to produce historians to theorize to that effect, systems subjected to randomness and unpredictability build a mechanism beyond the robust to opportunistically reinvent themselves each generation with a continuous change of population and species. Black Swan Management 101. Nature and nature-like systems likes diversity between organisms rather than diversity within an immortal organism. Unless you consider nature itself the immortal organism, as in the pantheism of Spinoza, or that present in Asian religions, or the Stoicism of Chrysippus or Epictetus. If you run into a historian of civilizations, try to explain it to him. Let us look at how evolution benefits from randomness and volatility, in some dose, of course. The more noise and disturbances in the system, up to a point, barring those extreme shocks that lead to extinction of a species, the more the effect of the reproduction of the fittest and that of random mutations will play a role in defining the properties of the next generation. Say an organism produces 10 offspring. If the environment is perfectly stable, all 10 will be able to reproduce. But if there is instability, pushing aside 5 of these descendants, likely to be on average weaker than their surviving siblings, then those that evolution considers, on balance, the better ones will reproduce, making the gene undergo some fitness. Likewise, if there is variability among the offspring, thanks to occasional random spontaneous mutation, a sort of copying mistake in the genetic code, then the best should reproduce, increasing the fitness of the species. So evolution benefits from randomness by 2 different routes, randomness in the mutations and randomness in the environment. Both act in a similar way to cause changes in the traits of the surviving next generations. Even when there is extinction of an entire species after some extreme event, no big deal. It is part of the game. This is still evolution at work, as those species that survive are fittest and take over from the lost dinosaurs. Evolution is not about a species, but at the service of the whole of nature. But note that evolution likes randomness only up to some limit. Strong antifragility is when the love of volatility knows no bound. The gains have a remote limit or are truly unlimited. The sky is the limit. These can only exist in artificial, man-made life, such as economic contracts and cultural products, not really in natural processes. If a calamity completely kills life on the entire planet, the fittest will not survive. Likewise, if random mutations occur at too high a rate, then the fitness gain might not stick, might perhaps even reverse thanks to a new mutation. As I will keep repeating, nature is antifragile up to a point, but such point is quite high. It can take a lot of shocks. Should a nuclear event eradicate most of life on Earth, but not all life, some rat or bacteria will emerge out of nowhere, perhaps the bottom of the oceans. And the story will start again, without us, and without the members of the Office of Management and Budget, of course. So, in a way, while hormesis corresponds to situations by which the individual organism benefits from direct harm to itself, evolution occurs when harm makes the individual organism perish, and the benefits are transferred to others, the surviving ones, and future generations. For an illustration of how families of organisms like harm in order to evolve, again up to a point, though not the organisms themselves, consider the phenomenon of antibiotic resistance. The harder you try to harm bacteria, the stronger the survivors will be, unless you can manage to eradicate them completely. The same with cancer therapy. Quite often, cancer cells that manage to survive the toxicity of chemotherapy and radiation reproduce faster and take over the void made by the weaker cells. Organisms are populations, and populations are organisms. The idea of viewing things in terms of populations, not individuals, with benefits to the latter stemming from harm to the former, came to me from the works on antifragility by the physicist-turned-geneticist Antoine Danchon. He and his co-authors published in the journal Genes a paper on the idea of antifragility in biological systems. Interestingly, the article was in response to a draft of this book. In turn, this book was modified in response to Danchon's article. For him, analysis needs to accommodate the fact that an organism is not something isolated and standalone. There are layering and hierarchies. If you view things in terms of population, you must transcend the terms hormesis and mithridatization as a characterization of antifragility. Why? To rephrase the argument made earlier, hormesis is a metaphor for direct antifragility, when an organism directly benefits from harm. With evolution, something hierarchically superior to that organism benefits from the damage. From the outside, it looks like there is hormesis, but from the inside, there are winners and losers. How does this layering operate? A tree has many branches, and these look like small trees. Further, these large branches have many more smaller branches that sort of look like even smaller trees. This is a manifestation of what is called fractal self-similarity, a vision by the mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot. There is a similar hierarchy in things, and we just see the top layer from the outside. The cell has a population of intercellular molecules. In turn, the organism has a population of cells, and the species has a population of organisms. A strengthening mechanism for the species comes at the expense of some organisms. In turn, the organism strengthens at the expense of some cells, all the way down and all the way up as well. For instance, if you drink a poisonous substance in small amounts, the mechanism by which your organism gets better is, according to Danchamp, evolutionary within your system, with bad and weak proteins in the cells replaced by stronger and younger ones, and the stronger ones being spared, or some similar operation. When you starve yourself of food, it is the bad proteins that are broken down first and recycled by your own body, a process called autophagy. This is a purely evolutionary process, one that selects and kills the weakest for fitness. But one does not need to accept the specific biological theory, like aging proteins and autophagy, to buy the general idea that survival pressures within the organism play a role in its overall improvement under external stress. Thank you, errors. Now we get into errors and how the errors of some people carry benefits for others. We can simplify the relationships between fragility, errors, and anti-fragility as follows. When you are fragile, you depend on things following the exact planned course, with as little deviation as possible, for deviations are more harmful than helpful. This is why the fragile needs to be very predictive in its approach, and, conversely, predictive systems cause fragility. When you want deviations and you don't care about the possible dispersion of outcomes that the future can bring, since most will be helpful, you are anti-fragile. Further, the random element in trial and error is not quite random if it is carried out rationally, using error as a source of information. If every trial provides you with information about what does not work, you start zooming in on a solution. So every attempt becomes more valuable, more like an expense than an error. And of course, you make discoveries along the way. Learning from the mistakes of others. But recall that this chapter is about layering, units, hierarchies, fractal structure, and the difference between the interest of a unit and those of its subunits. So it is often the mistakes of others that benefit the rest of us, and, sadly, not them. We saw that stressors are information, in the right context. For the anti-fragile, harm from errors should be less than the benefits. We are talking about some, not all, errors, of course. Those that do not destroy a system help prevent larger calamities. The engineer and historian of engineering, Henry Petrosky, presents a very elegant point. Had the Titanic not had that famous accident, as fatal as it was, we would have kept building larger and larger ocean liners, and the next disaster would have been even more tragic. So the people who perished were sacrificed for the greater good. They unarguably saved more lives than were lost. The story of the Titanic illustrates the difference between gains for the system and harm to some of its individual parts. The same can be said of the debacle of Fukushima. One can safely say that it made us aware of the problem with nuclear reactors and small probabilities, and prevented larger catastrophes. Note that the errors of naive stress testing and reliance on risk models were quite obvious at the time. As with the economic crisis, nobody wanted to listen. Every plane crash brings us closer to safety, improves the system, and makes the next flight safer. Those who perish contribute to the overall safety of others. Swiss Flight 111, TWA Flight 800, and Air France Flight 447 allowed the improvement of the system. But these systems learn because they are anti-fragile and set up to exploit small errors. The same cannot be said of economic crashes, since the economic system is not anti-fragile the way it is presently built. Why? There are hundreds of thousands of plane flights every year, and a crash in one plane does not involve others. So errors remain confined and highly epistemic. Whereas globalized economic systems operate as one, errors spread and compound. Again, crucially, we are talking of partial, not general, mistakes. small, not severe and terminal ones. This creates a separation between good and bad systems. Good systems, such as airlines, are set up to have small errors, independent from each other, or, in effect, negatively correlated to each other, since mistakes lower the odds of future mistakes. This is one way to see how one environment can be anti-fragile, aviation, and the other fragile, modern economic life with Earth-is-flat-style interconnectedness. If every plane crash makes the next one less likely, every bank crash makes the next one more likely. We need to eliminate the second type of error, the one that produces contagion in our construction of an ideal socioeconomic system. Let us examine Mother Nature once again. The natural was built from non-systemic mistake to non-systemic mistake. My errors lifting stones, when I am well calibrated, translate into small injuries that guide me the next time, as I try to avoid pain. After all, that's the purpose of pain. Leopards, who move like a true symphony of nature, are not instructed by personal trainers on the proper form to lift a deer up a tree. Human advice might work with artificial sports, like, say, tennis, bowling, or gun shooting, not with natural movements. Some businesses love their own mistakes. Reinsurance companies, who focus on insuring catastrophic risks and are used by insurance companies to reinsure such non-diversifiable risks, manage to do well after a calamity or tail event that causes them to take a hit. If they are still in business and have their powder dry, few manage to have plans for such contingency, they make it up by disproportionately raising premia. Customers overreact and pay up for insurance. They claim to have no idea about fair value, that is, proper pricing for reinsurance, but they certainly know that it is overpriced at times of stress, which is sufficient to them to make a long-term shekel. All they need is to keep their mistakes small enough so they can survive them. How to become Mother Teresa? Variability causes mistakes and adaptations. It also allows you to know who your friends are. Both your failures and your successes will give you information. But, and this is one of the good things in life, sometimes you only know about someone's character after you harm them with an error for which you are solely responsible. I have been astonished at the generosity of some persons in the way they forgave me for my mistakes. And of course you learn from the errors of others. You may never know what type of person someone is unless they are given opportunities to violate moral or ethical codes. I remember a classmate, a girl in high school, who seemed nice and honest and part of my childhood group of anti-materialistic utopists. I learned that against my expectations and her innocent looks, she didn't turn out to become Mother Teresa or Rosa Luxemburg, as she dumped her first rich husband for another richer person, whom she dumped upon his first financial difficulties for yet another richer and more powerful and generous lover. In a non-volatile environment, I, and most probably she too, would have mistaken her for a utopist and a saint. Some members of society, those who did not marry her, got valuable information, while others, her victims, paid the price. Further, my characterization of a loser is someone who, after making a mistake, doesn't introspect, doesn't exploit it, feels embarrassed and defensive rather than enriched with a new piece of information, and tries to explain why he made the mistake rather than moving on. These types often consider themselves the victims of some large plot, a bad boss, or bad weather. Finally, a thought. He who has never sinned is less reliable than he who has only sinned once. And someone who has made plenty of errors, though never the same error more than once, is more reliable than someone who has never made any. Why the aggregate hates the individual. We saw that antifragility in biology works thanks to layers. This rivalry between suborganisms contributes to evolution. Cells within our bodies compete. Within the cells, proteins compete, all the way through. Let us translate the point into human endeavors. The economy has an equivalent layering. Individuals, artisans, small firms, departments within corporations, industries, the regional economy, and finally, on top, the general economy. One can even have thinner slicing with a larger number of layers. For the economy to be anti-fragile and undergo what is called evolution, every single individual business must necessarily be fragile, exposed to breaking. Evolution needs organisms, or their genes, to die when supplanted by others, in order to achieve improvement, or to avoid reproduction when they are not as fit as someone else. Accordingly, the anti-fragility of the higher level may require the fragility and sacrifice of the lower one. Every time you use a coffee maker for your morning cappuccino, you are benefiting from the fragility of the coffee-making entrepreneur who failed. He failed in order to help put the superior merchandise on your kitchen counter. Also, consider traditional societies. There, too, we have a similar layering. Individuals, immediate families, extended families, tribes, people using the same dialects, ethnicities, groups. While sacrifice as a modus is obvious in the case of ant colonies, I am certain that individual businessmen are not overly interested in harakiri for the greater good of the economy. They are therefore necessarily concerned in seeking anti-fragility, or at least some level of robustness for themselves. That's not necessarily compatible with the interest of the collective, that is, the economy. So there is a problem in which the property of the sum, the aggregate, varies from that of each one of the parts. In fact, it wants harm to the parts. It is painful to think about ruthlessness as an engine of improvement. Now, what is the solution? There is none, alas, that can please everyone, but there are ways to mitigate the harm to the very weak. The problem is graver than you think. People go to business school to learn how to do well while ensuring their survival. But what the economy, as a collective, wants them to do is to not survive, rather to take a lot of imprudent risks themselves and be blinded by the odds. Their respective industries improve from failure to failure. Natural and nature-like systems want some overconfidence on the part of individual economic agents, that is, the overestimation of their chances of success and underestimation of the risks of failure in their businesses, provided their failure does not impact others. In other words, they want local but not global overconfidence. We saw that the restaurant business is wonderfully efficient precisely because restaurants, being vulnerable, go bankrupt every minute, and entrepreneurs ignore such a possibility, as they think that they will beat the odds. In other words, some class of rash, even suicidal, risk-taking is healthy for the economy, under the condition that not all people take the same risks and that these risks remain small and localized. Now, by disrupting the model, as we will see, with bailouts, governments typically favor a certain class of firms that are large enough to require being saved in order to avoid contagion to other business. This is the opposite of healthy risk-taking. It is transferring fragility from the collective to the unfit. People have difficulty realizing that the solution is building a system in which nobody's fall can drag others down, for continuous failures work to preserve the system. Paradoxically, many government interventions and social policies end up hurting the weak and consolidating the established. What does not kill me kills others. Time to debunk a myth. As an advocate of anti-fragility, I need to warn about illusions of seeing it when it is not really there. We can mistake the anti-fragility of the system for that of the individual, when in fact it takes place at the expense of the individual, the difference between hormesis and selection. Nietzsche's famous expression, "What does not kill me makes me stronger," can be easily misinterpreted as meaning mithridatization or hormesis. It may be one of these two phenomena, very possible, but it could as well mean, "What did not kill me did not make me stronger, but spared me because I am stronger than others. But it killed others, and the average population is now stronger because the weak are gone." In other words, I passed an exit exam. I've discussed the problem in earlier writings of the false illusion of causality, with a newspaper article saying that the new mafia members, former Soviet exiles, had been hardened by a visit to the Gulag, the Soviet concentration camps. Since the sojourn in the Gulag killed the weakest, one had the illusion of strengthening. Sometimes we see people having survived trials and imagine, given that the surviving population is sturdier than the original one, that these trials are good for them. In other words, the trial can just be a ruthless exam that kills those who fail. All we may be witnessing is that transfer of fragility, rather anti-fragility, from the individual to the system that I discussed earlier. Let me present it in a different way. The surviving cohort, clearly, is stronger than the initial one, but not quite the individuals, since the weaker ones died. Someone paid a price for the system to improve. Me and us. This visible tension between individual and collective interests is new in history. In the past, it was dealt with by the near irrelevance of individuals. Sacrifice for the sake of the group is behind the notion of heroism. It is good for the tribe, bad for those who perish under the fever of war. This instinct for heroism and the fading of individual interests in favor of the communal has become aberrant with suicide bombers. These pre-death terrorists get into a mood similar to an ecstatic trance in which their emotions drive them to become indifferent to their own mortality. It is a fallacy that suicide bombers are driven by the promise of a reward, of some Islamic paradise with virgins and other entertainment. For, as the anthropologist Scott Atran has pointed out, the first suicide bombers in the Levant were revolutionaries of Greek Orthodox background. My tribe, not Islamists. There is something like a switch in us that kills the individual in favor of the collective when people engage in communal dances, mass riots, or war. Your mood is now that of the herd. You are part of what Elias Canetti calls the rhythmic and throbbing crowd. You can also feel a different variety of crowd experience during your next street riot, when fear of authorities vanishes completely under group fever. Let us now generalize the point. Looking at the world from a certain distance, I see a total tension between man and nature, a tension in the trade-off of fragilities. We saw how nature wants herself, the aggregate, to survive, not every species, just as, in turn, every single species wants its individuals to be fragile, particularly after reproduction, for evolutionary selection to take place. We saw how such transfer of fragility from individuals to species is necessary for its overall survival. Species are potentially anti-fragile, given that DNA is information, but members of the species are perishable, hence ready to sacrifice and in reality designed to do so for the benefit of the collective. Anti-fragility, smanti-fragility. Some of the ideas about fitness and selection here are not very comfortable to this author, which makes the writing of some sections rather painful. I detest the ruthlessness of selection, the inexorable disloyalty of Mother Nature. I detest the notion of improvement thanks to harm to others. As a humanist, I stand against the anti-fragility of systems at the expense of individuals, for if you follow the reasoning, this makes us humans individually irrelevant. The great benefit of the Enlightenment has been to bring the individual to the fore, with his rights, his freedom, his independence, his pursuit of happiness, whatever that happiness means, and, most of all, his privacy. In spite of its denial of anti-fragility, the Enlightenment and the political systems that emerged from it freed us, somewhat, from the domination of society, the tribe, and the family that had prevailed throughout history. The unit in traditional cultures is the collective, and it could be perceived to be harmed by the behavior of an individual. The honor of the family is sullied when, say, a daughter becomes pregnant, or a member of the family engages in large-scale financial swindles and Ponzi schemes, or, worst, may even teach a college course in the charlatanic subject of financial economics. And these mores persist. Even as recently as the late 19th century or early 20th, it was common in, say, rural France, for someone to spend all his savings to erase the debts of a remote cousin, a practice called passer l'éponge, literally, to use a sponge to erase the liability from the chalkboard, and to do so in order to preserve the dignity and good name of the extended family. It was perceived as a duty. I confess having done some of that myself in the 21st century. Clearly, the system needs to be there for the individual to survive. So one needs to be careful in glorifying one interest against others in the presence of interdependence and complexity. Many people think at first that their own death is the worst black swan scenario. It is not. Unless they've studied too much modern economics, they would agree explicitly that their death plus the death of their loved ones plus the termination of humanity would be a vastly worse outcome than their own death. Recall my comment on complex systems. We are a mere part of a large chain, and we are worried about both ourselves and the system, as well as the preservation of parts of that large chain. In the Cosa Nostra, the Sicilian mafia, the designation man of honor, uomo d'onore, implies that the person caught by the police would remain silent and not rat on his friends, regardless of benefits, and that life in prison is preferable to a plea that entails hurting other members. The tribe, Cosa Nostra, comes before the individual. And what broke the back of the mafia was the recent generation of plea bargainers. Note that honor in the mafia is limited to such in-group solidarity. They otherwise lie, and there is nothing honorable about them in other domains. And they kill people from behind, something that on the east side of the Mediterranean is considered the purest form of cowardice. Likewise, we humans may have to be self-centered at the expense of other species, at the risk of ecological fragility, if it ensures our survival. Our interests as a human race prevail over those of nature, and we can tolerate some inefficiency, some fragility, in order to protect individuals, although sacrificing nature too much may eventually hurt ourselves. We saw the trade-off between the interests of the collective and those of the individual. An economy cannot survive without breaking individual eggs. Protection is harmful, and constraining the forces of evolution to benefit individuals does not seem required. But we can shield individuals from starvation, provide some social protection, and give them respect. Or more, as we see next. National Entrepreneur Day. Meanwhile, if as a utopist, indeed, I hate what I am figuring out, I think that there is hope. Heroism and the respect it commands is a form of compensation by society for those who take risks for others, and entrepreneurship is a risky and heroic activity, necessary for growth or even the mere survival of the economy. It is also necessarily collective on epistemological grounds to facilitate the development of expertise. Someone who did not find something is providing others with knowledge, the best knowledge, that of absence. What does not work, yet he gets little or no credit for it. He is a central part of the process with incentives going to others and, what is worse, gets no respect. A correspondent, Jean-Louis Roll, wrote, "I have noticed that the more people glorify the entrepreneur as an abstraction, the more they will scorn an actual one they meet." I am an ingrate toward the man whose overconfidence caused him to open a restaurant and fail, enjoying my nice meal while he is probably eating canned tuna. In order to progress, modern society should be treating ruined entrepreneurs in the same way we honor dead soldiers, perhaps not with as much honor, but using exactly the same logic. The entrepreneur is still alive, though perhaps morally broken and socially stigmatized, particularly if he lives in Japan. For there is no such thing as a failed soldier, dead or alive, unless he acted in a cowardly manner. Likewise, there is no such thing as a failed entrepreneur or failed scientific researcher, any more than there is a successful babbler, philosophaster, commentator, consultant, lobbyist, or business school professor who does not take personal risks. Sorry. Psychologists label overconfidence a disease, blinding people to the odds of success when engaging in ventures. But there is a difference between the benign, heroic type of risk-taking that is beneficial to others, in the anti-fragile case, and the nastier modern type related to negative black swans, such as the overconfidence of scientists computing the risks of harm from the Fukushima reactor. In the case of the former, what they call overconfidence is a good thing, not something to medicate. And compare entrepreneurs to the bean-counting managers of companies who climb the ladder of hierarchy with hardly ever any real downside. Their cohort is rarely at risk. What Erasmus called ingratitudo vulgi, the ingratitude of the masses, is increasing in the age of globalization and the Internet. My dream, the solution, is that we would have a National Entrepreneur Day with the following message. Most of you will fail, disrespected, impoverished. But we are grateful for the risks you are taking and the sacrifices you are making for the sake of the economic growth of the planet and pulling others out of poverty. You are at the source of our anti-fragility. Our nation thanks you. Book 2. Modernity and the Denial of Anti-Fragility. As in Baudelaire's sad poem about the albatross, what is made to fly will not do well trapped on the ground, where it is forced to traipse. And it is quite fitting that volatility comes from volare, to fly, in Latin. Depriving political and other systems of volatility harms them, causing eventually greater volatility of the cascading type. This section, Book 2, deals with the fragility that comes from the denial of hormesis, the natural anti-fragility of organisms, and how we hurt systems with the very best of intentions by playing conductor. We are fragilizing social and economic systems by denying them stressors and randomness, putting them in the Procrustean bed of cushy and comfortable, but ultimately harmful, modernity. Procrustes was an innkeeper in Greek mythology who, in order to make the travelers fit in his bed, cut the limbs of those who were too tall and stretched those who were too short. But he had the bed fitting the visitor with total perfection. As we saw in Chapter 3, treating an organism like a simple machine is a kind of simplification or approximation or reduction that is exactly like a Procrustean bed. It is often with the most noble intentions that we do so, as we are pressured to fix things, so we often blow them up with our fear of randomness and love of smoothness. Where simplifications fail, causing the most damage, is when something non-linear is simplified with the linear as a substitute. That is the most common Procrustean bed. Book 2 will also discuss the competition between man and natural forces, the craving of volatility by some anti-fragile systems, and how we make social, political, and other systems vulnerable to black swans when we overstabilize them. Chapter 5. Two different randomness categories seen through the profiles of two brothers. How Switzerland is not controlled from above. The difference between mediocristan and extremistan, the virtues of city-states, bottom-up political systems, and the stabilizing effect of municipal noise. The souk and the office building. The reds and the whites all go to Zurich. War is not a prison. The turkeys thwarted projects. Remember, we are in extremistan. Two types of professions. Consider the fate of Ioannis, John, and Georgios, George, two identical twin brothers, born in Cyprus, both of them, currently both living in the greater London area. John has been employed for 25 years as a clerk in the personnel department of a large bank, dealing with the relocation of employees around the globe. George is a taxi driver. John has a perfectly predictable income, or so he thinks, with benefits, 4 weeks annual vacation, and a gold watch every 25 years of employment. Every month, £3,082 is deposited in his local NatWest checking account. He spends a portion of it for the mortgage on his house west of London, the utilities, and feta cheese, and has a bit left for his savings. He used to wake up on Saturday morning, the day when people stretch and linger in bed, anxiety-free, telling himself, "Life is good." Until the banking crisis, when he realized that his job could be made redundant. Unemployment would seriously hit him hard. As a personnel expert, he has seen the implosions of long careers with persons who, laid off at the age of 50, never recovered. George, who lives on the same street as his brother, drives a black taxi, meaning he has a license for which he spent 3 years expanding his frontal lobes by memorizing streets and itineraries in Greater London, which gives him the right to pick up clients in the streets. His income is extremely variable. Some days are good. He earns several hundred pounds. Some are worse, when he does not even cover his costs. But, year after year, he averages about the same as his brother. To date, he has only had a single day in his 25-year career without a fare. Because of the variability of his income, he keeps moaning that he does not have the job security of his brother. But in fact, this is an illusion, for he has a bit more. This is the central illusion in life, that randomness is risky, that it is a bad thing, and that eliminating randomness is done by eliminating randomness. Artisans, say taxi drivers, prostitutes, a very, very old profession, carpenters, plumbers, tailors, and dentists have some volatility in their income, but they are rather robust to a minor professional black swan, one that would bring their income to a complete halt. Their risks are visible. Not so with employees, who have no volatility, but can be surprised to see their income going to zero after a phone call from the personnel department. Employees' risks are hidden. Thanks to variability, these artisanal careers harbor a bit of anti-fragility. Small variations make them adapt and change continuously by learning from the environment and being, sort of, continuously under pressure to be fit. Remember that stressors are information. These careers face a continuous supply of these stressors that make them adjust opportunistically. In addition, they are open to gifts and positive surprises, free options, the hallmark of anti-fragility, as we will see in Book 4. George was used to having, once in a while, a crazy request, one he was free to decline. During the Icelandic volcano scare, when UK air traffic was shut down, he was asked by a rich old lady to drive her to a wedding in the south of France, a 2,000-mile round-trip journey. Likewise, a prostitute faces the small probability of seeing a severely infatuated rich client give her a very expensive diamond, or even an offer of matrimony, in what can be expected to be a short transitional period before her widowhood. And George has the freedom to continue until he drops. Many people continue to drive cabs into their 80s, mostly to kill time, since he is his own boss, compared to his brother, who is completely unhireable in his 50s. The difference between the two volatilities in income applies to political systems, and, as we will see in the next two chapters, to about everything in life. Man-made smoothing of randomness produces the equivalent of John's income, smooth, steady, but fragile. Such income is more vulnerable to large shocks that can make it go to zero, plus some unemployment benefits if he resides in one of the few welfare states. Natural randomness presents itself more like George's income, smaller role for very large shocks, but daily variability. Further, such variability helps improve the system, hence the anti-fragility. A week with declining earnings for a taxi driver or a prostitute provides information concerning the environment and intimates the need to find a new part of town where clients hang around. A month or so without earnings drives them to revise their skills. Further, for a self-employed person, a small, non-terminal mistake is information, valuable information, one that directs him in his adaptive approach. For someone employed like John, a mistake is something that goes into his permanent record, filed in the personnel department. Yogi Berra once said, "We made the wrong mistake." And for John, all mistakes are wrong mistakes. Nature loves small errors, without which genetic variations are impossible. Humans don't. Hence, when you rely on human judgment, you are at the mercy of a mental bias that disfavors anti-fragility. So, alas, we humans are afraid of the second type of variability and naively fragilize systems, or prevent their anti-fragility, by protecting them. In other words, a point worth repeating every time it applies, this avoidance of small mistakes makes the large ones more severe. The centralized state resembles the income of John, the city-state model that of George. John has one large employer, George many small ones, so he can select the ones that fit him the best and hence has, at any point in time, more options. One has the illusion of stability, but is fragile. The other one, the illusion of variability, but is robust and even anti-fragile. The more variability you observe in a system, the less black swan prone it is. Let us now examine how this applies to political systems with the story of Switzerland. Lenin in Zurich. I was recently in a cafe-turned-expensive restaurant in Zurich, poring over the overpriced menu, with prices at least triple of those in a place of equivalent quality in the United States. The world's recent crisis had made Switzerland even more of a safe haven than it had ever been, causing its currency to rise dramatically. Switzerland is the most anti-fragile place on the planet. It benefits from shocks that take place in the rest of the world. The friend, a writer, pointed out to me that Lenin, who lived in town, used to play chess in the cafe with a Dadaist poet Tristan Tzara. Yes, the Russian revolutionary Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, later known as Lenin, spent some time in Switzerland, concocting his project of the great top-down modernistic state and largest human experiment in centralized state control. It hit me that there was something eerie in Lenin's presence there, for, a few days before, I had been at a conference in Montreux on Lake Geneva that took place in the same lakefront hotel where Vladimir Nabokov, the emigre Russian aristocrat and victim of Lenin, spent the last couple of decades of his life. It seemed interesting to me that sheltering the Reds and the Whites, both the Bolsheviks and the aristocratic White Russians they later displaced, seems to be part of the primary business of the Helvetic Confederation. The main cities, such as Zurich, Geneva, or Lausanne, bear traces of the political refugees who went there for shelter. Emigres, from the Iranian royals thrown out by the Islamists to the latest African potentate executing Plan B. Even Voltaire spent some time hiding in the place, in Ferney, a suburb of Geneva near the French border, before it even joined the Confederation. Voltaire, the perfectly protected gadfly, would rush to Ferney after insulting the King of France, the Catholic Church, or some other authority. What people don't usually know about him is that he also had an incentive to seek protection there for financial reasons. Voltaire was a self-made man, a wealthy merchant, investor, and speculative dealer. It is worth noting that much of his wealth came from the anti-fragility of stressors, as he started building his fortune during his early exile. So, like Voltaire, there are refugees of other types. Financial refugees coming from places of turmoil, recognizable by their expensive and boring clothes, bland vocabulary, contrived decorum, and expensive, shiny watches. In other words, non-Voltaires. Like many rich people, they feel entitled to laugh at their own jokes. These dull people are not looking for personal shelter. It is their assets that are seeking refuge. While some political persons might prefer to hide from the risks of their national regime in France or England, more exciting places on Saturday night, it is most certainly in Switzerland that their checking account wants to be. It is economically the most robust place on the planet, and it has been so for quite a few centuries. This great variety of people and their wallets are there, in Switzerland, for its shelter, safety, and stability. But all these refugees don't notice the obvious. The most stable country in the world does not have a government. And it is not stable in spite of not having a government. It is stable because it does not have one. Ask random Swiss citizens to name their president, and count the proportion of people who can do so. They can usually name the presidents of France or the United States, but not their own. Its currency works best, at the time of writing it proved to be the safest, yet its central bank is tiny, even relative to its size. Do these politicians biding their time before, they hope, returning to power, notice such absence of government, accept that they are in Switzerland because of such absence of government, and adapt their ideas on nation-states and political systems accordingly? Not at all. It is not quite true that the Swiss do not have a government. What they do not have is a large central government, or what the common discourse describes as the government. What governs them is entirely bottom-up, municipal of sorts, regional entities called cantons, near-sovereign mini-states united in a confederation. There is plenty of volatility, with enmities between residents that stay at the level of fights over water fountains or other such uninspiring debates. This is not necessarily pleasant, since neighbors are transformed into busybodies. This is a dictatorship from the bottom, not from the top, but a dictatorship nonetheless. But this bottom-up form of dictatorship provides protection against the romanticism of utopias, to understand that the process is highly unintellectual, devoid of any sense of the grandiose, even downright puny. There is a famous quip about how the greatest accomplishment of the Swiss was inventing the cuckoo clock, while other nations produced great works. Nice story, except that the Swiss did not invent the cuckoo clock. But the system produces stability, boring stability, at every possible level. Also note that the hideously glitzy scenes one encounters in Switzerland, in all of Geneva, in some parts of Zurich, the center, and particularly in the ski resorts such as Gstaad and St. Moritz, are not the direct product of the country, nor part of its mission, but the result of its success, as Switzerland acts as a magnet for the ugly rich and tax refugees. Note for now that this is the last major country that is not a nation-state, but rather a collection of small municipalities left to their own devices. Bottom-up variations. What I call bottom-up variations, or noise, is the type of political volatility that takes place within a municipality, the petty fights and frictions in the running of regular affairs. It is not scalable, or what is called invariant under scale transformation. In other words, if you increase the size, say, multiply the number of people in a community by 100, you will have markedly different dynamics. A large state does not behave at all like a gigantic municipality, much as a baby human does not resemble a smaller adult. The difference is qualitative. The increase in the number of persons in a given community alters the quality of the relationship between parties. Recall the nonlinearity description from the prologue. If you multiply by 10 the number of persons in a given entity, you do not preserve the properties. There is a transformation. Here, conversations switch from the mundane, but effective, to abstract numbers. More interesting, more academic perhaps, but, alas, less effective. A cluster of municipalities with charming provincial enmities, their own internal fights, and people out to get one another aggregates to a quite benign and stable state. Switzerland is similar to the income of the second brother, stable because of the variations in noise at the local level. Just as the income of the cab driver shows instability on a daily basis, but annual stability, likewise Switzerland shows stability at the aggregate level, as the ensemble of cantons produces a solid system. The way people handle local affairs is vastly different from the way they handle large, abstract public expenditures. We have traditionally lived in small units and tribes and managed rather well in small units. Further, biology plays a role in a municipal environment, not in a larger system. An administration is shielded from having to feel the sting of shame with flushing in his face, a biological reaction to overspending and other failures, such as killing people in Vietnam. Eye contact with one's peers changes one's behavior. But for a desk-grounded office leech, a number is just a number. Someone you see in church Sunday morning would feel uncomfortable for his mistakes, and more responsible for them. On the small, local scale, his body and biological response would direct him to avoid causing harm to others. On a large scale, others are abstract items. Given the lack of social contact with the people concerned, the civil servant's brain leads rather than his emotions, with numbers, spreadsheets, statistics, more spreadsheets, and theories. When I expressed this idea to my co-author, Mark Blythe, he blurted out the obvious. Stalin could not have existed in a municipality. Small is beautiful in so many other ways. Take for now that the small, in the aggregate, that is, a collection of small units, is more anti-fragile than the large. In fact, the large is doomed to breaking, a mathematical property we will explain later that, sadly, seems universal as it applies to large corporations, very large mammals, and large administrations. It is quite distressing to hear debates about political systems that make comparisons between countries when the size of the entities is not the same. Say, comparing Singapore to Malaysia. The size of the unit may matter more than the system. There is another issue with the abstract state, a psychological one. We humans scorn what is not concrete. We are more easily swayed by a crying baby than by thousands of people dying elsewhere that do not make it to our living room through the TV set. The one case is a tragedy, the other a statistic. Our emotional energy is blind to probability. The media make things worse as they play on our infatuation with anecdotes, our thirst for the sensational, and they cause a great deal of unfairness that way. At the present time, one person is dying of diabetes every 7 seconds, but the news can only talk about victims of hurricanes with houses flying in the air. The problem is that by creating bureaucracies, we put civil servants in a position to make decisions based on abstract and theoretical matters, with the illusion that they will be making them in a rational, accountable way. Also consider that lobbyists, this annoying race of lobbyists, cannot exist in a municipality or small region. The Europeans, thanks to the centralization of some power with the European Commission in Brussels, are quickly discovering the existence of these mutants coming to manipulate democracy for the sake of some large corporation. By influencing one single decision or regulation in Brussels, a single lobbyist gets a large bang. It is a much larger payoff, at low cost, than with municipalities, which would require armies of lobbyists trying to convince people while embedded in their communities. Thankfully, the European Union is legally protected from over-centralization thanks to the principle of subsidiarity. Things should be handled by the smallest possible unit that can manage them with efficacy. The idea was inherited from the Catholic Church. Philosophically, a unit doesn't need to be very large, the state, nor very small, the individual, but somewhere in between. This is a powerful philosophical statement, particularly in light of both the transfers of fragility we saw in Chapter 4 and the notion that size fragilizes, much on which later. Consider, too, the other effect of scale. Small corporations are less likely to have lobbyists. The same bottom-up effect applies to law. The Italian political and legal philosopher Bruno Leone has argued in favor of the robustness of judge-based law, owing to its diversity, as compared to explicit and rigid codifications. True, the choice of a court could be a lottery, but it helps prevent large-scale mistakes. I use the example of Switzerland to show the natural anti-fragility of political systems and how stability is achieved by managing noise, having a mechanism for letting it run its natural course, not by minimizing it. Note another element of Switzerland. It is perhaps the most successful country in history, yet it has traditionally had a very low level of university education compared to the rest of the rich nations. Its system, even in banking during my days, was based on apprenticeship models, nearly vocational rather than theoretical ones. In other words, on techne, crafts and know-how, not episteme, book knowledge, know-what. Away from Extremistan. Let us now examine the technical aspects of the process, a more statistical view of the effect of human intervention on the volatility of affairs. There is a certain mathematical property to this bottom-up volatility, and to the volatility of natural systems. It generates the kind of randomness I call mediocristan, plenty of variations that might be scary but tend to cancel out in the aggregate, over time or over the collection of municipalities that constitute the larger confederation or entity, rather than the unruly one called extremistan, in which you have mostly stability and occasionally large chaos. Errors there have large consequences. One fluctuates, the other jumps. One has a lot of small variations, the other varies in lumps. Just like the income of the driver compared to that of bank employee, the two types of randomness are qualitatively distinct. Mediocristan has a lot of variations, not a single one of which is extreme. Extremistan has few variations, but those that take place are extreme. Another way to understand the difference. Your caloric intake is from mediocristan. If you add the calories you consume in a year, even without adjusting for your lies, not a single day will represent much of the total, say more than 0.5% of the total, 5,000 calories when you may consume 800,000 in a year. So the exception, the rare event, plays an inconsequential role in the aggregate and the long term. You cannot double your weight in a single day, not even a month, not possibly in a year, but you can double your net worth or lose half of it in a single moment. By comparison, if you take the sale of novels, more than half of sales, and perhaps 90% of profits, tends to come from the top 0.1%. So the exception, the 1-in-1,000 event, is dominant there. So financial matters and other economic matters tend to be from extremistan, just like history, which moves by discontinuities and jumps from one state to another. When randomness gets distributed across a large number of small units, along with small recurrent political disorder, we get the first type, the benign mediocristan. When randomness concentrates, we get the second type, the sneaky extremistan. Graphic 2 of your PDF file illustrates how antifragile systems are hurt when they are deprived of their natural variations, mostly thanks to naive intervention. Beyond municipal noise, the same logic applies to the child who, after spending time in a sterilized environment, is left out in the open, a system with dictated political stability from the top, the effects of price controls, the advantages of size for a corporation, etc. We switch from a system that produces steady but controllable volatility, mediocristan, closer to the statistical bell curve, from the benign family of the Gaussian or normal distribution, into one that is highly unpredictable and moves mostly by jumps, called fat tails. Fat tails, a synonym for extremistan, mean that remote events, those in what is called the tails, play a disproportionate role. One, the first graph in graphic 2, is volatile. It fluctuates but does not sink. The other, the second graph in graphic 2, sinks without significant fluctuations outside the episodes of turmoil. In the long run, the second system will be far more volatile. But volatility comes in lumps. When we constrain the first system, we tend to get the second outcome. Note also that in extremistan, predictability is very low. In the second, pseudo-smooth kind of randomness, mistakes appear to be rare, but they will be large, often devastating when they occur. Actually, an argument we develop in Book 4, anything locked into planning tends to fail precisely because of these attributes. It is quite a myth that planning helps corporations. In fact, we saw that the world is too random and unpredictable to base a policy on visibility of the future. What survives comes from the interplay of some fitness and environmental conditions. The Great Turkey Problem. Let me now move back from the technical jargon and graphs of fat tails and extremistan to colloquial Lebanese. In extremistan, one is prone to be fooled by the properties of the past and get the story exactly backwards. It is easy, looking at what is happening in the second graph of graphic 2, before the big jump down, to believe that the system is now safe, particularly when the system has made a progressive switch from the scary type of visibly volatile randomness at left to the apparently safe right. It looks like a drop in volatility, and it is not. A turkey is fed for 1,000 days by a butcher. Every day confirms to its staff of analysts that butchers love turkeys with increased statistical confidence. The butcher will keep feeding the turkey until a few days before Thanksgiving. Then comes the day when it is really not a very good idea to be a turkey. So, with the butcher surprising it, the turkey will have a revision of belief, right when its confidence in the statement that the butcher loves turkeys is maximal and it is very quiet and soothingly predictable in the life of the turkey. This example builds on an adaptation of a metaphor by Bertrand Russell. The key here is that such a surprise will be a black swan event, but just for the turkey, not for the butcher. We can also see from the turkey story the mother of all harmful mistakes. Mistaking absence of evidence of harm for evidence of absence. A mistake that we will see tends to prevail in intellectual circles, and one that is grounded in the social sciences. So our mission in life becomes simply how not to be a turkey, or, if possible, how to be a turkey in reverse, anti-fragile, that is. Not being a turkey starts with figuring out the difference between true and manufactured stability. Likewise, before the events known as the Arab Spring of 2011, we were duped by Egypt and Syria, and are, as I am writing this, fooled by Saudi Arabia, about which a bit later. The reader can easily imagine what happens when constrained, volatility-choked systems explode. We have a fitting example: the removal of the Ba'ath Party, with the abrupt toppling of Saddam Hussein and his regime in 2003 by the United States. More than 100,000 persons died, and 10 years later, the place is still a mess. 12,000 years. We started the discussion of the state with the example of Switzerland. Now let us go a little bit farther east. The northern Levant, roughly today's northern part of Syria and Lebanon, stayed perhaps the most prosperous province in the history of mankind over the long, very long stretch of time from the pre-pottery Neolithic until very modern history, the middle of the 20th century. That's 12,000 years compared to, say, England, which has been prosperous for about 500 years, or Scandinavia, now only prosperous for less than 300 years. Few areas on the planet have managed to thrive with so much continuity over any protracted stretch of time, what historians call longue durée. Other cities came and went: Aleppo, Emesa, today Homs, and Laodicea, Latakia, stayed relatively affluent. The northern Levant was since ancient times dominated by traders, largely owing to its position as a central spot on the Silk Road, and by agricultural lords, as the province supplied wheat to much of the Mediterranean world, particularly Rome. The area supplied a few Roman emperors, a few Catholic popes before the schisms, and more than 30 Greek-language writers and philosophers, which includes many of the heads of Plato's Academy, in addition to the ancestors of the American visionary and computer entrepreneur Steve Jobs, who brought us the Apple computer, on one of which I am recopying these lines, and the iPad tablet, on which you may be reading them. We know of the autonomy of the province from the records during Roman days, as it was then managed by the local elites, a decentralized method of ruling through locals that the Ottoman retained. Cities minted their own coins. Then two events took place. First, after the Great War, one part of the northern Levant was integrated into the newly created nation of Syria, separated from its other section, now part of Lebanon. The entire area had been until then part of the Ottoman Empire, but functioned as somewhat autonomous regions. Ottomans, like the Romans before them, let local elites run the place so long as sufficient tax was paid, while they focused on their business of war. The Ottoman type of imperial peace, the Pax Ottomana, like its predecessor, the Pax Romana, was good for commerce. Contracts were enforced, and that is what governments are needed for the most. In the recent nostalgic book Levant, Philip Mansell documents how the cities of the Eastern Mediterranean operated as city-states, separated from the hinterland. Then, a few decades into the life of Syria, the modernist Ba'ath Party came to further enforce utopias. As soon as the Ba'athists centralized the place and enforced their statist laws, Aleppo and Emesa went into instant decline. What the Ba'ath Party did in its modernization program was to remove the archaic mess of the souks and replace them with the crisp modernism of the office building. The effect was immediately visible. Overnight, the trading families moved to places such as New York and New Jersey for the Jews, California for the Armenians, and Beirut for the Christians. Beirut offered a commerce-friendly atmosphere, and Lebanon was a benign, smaller, disorganized state without any real central government. Lebanon was small enough to be a municipality on its own. It was smaller than a medium-sized metropolitan area. War, prison, or both? But while Lebanon had all the right qualities, the state was too loose, and by allowing the various Palestinian factions to own weapons, it caused an arms race between the communities while placidly watching the entire build-up. Disorganized is invigorating, but the Lebanese state was one step too disorganized. It would be like allowing each of the New York mafia bosses to have a larger army than the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Just imagine John Gotti with missiles. So in 1975, a raging civil war started in Lebanon. A sentence that still shocks me when I think about it was voiced by one of my grandfather's friends, a wealthy Aleppan merchant who fled the Ba'ath regime. When my grandfather asked his friend during the Lebanese War why he did not go back to Aleppo, his answer was categorical. "We people of Aleppo prefer war to prison." I thought he meant that they were going to put him in jail, but then I realized that by prison he meant the loss of political and economic freedoms. Economic life, too, seems to prefer war to prison. Lebanon and northern Syria had very similar wealth per individual, what economists call gross domestic product, about a century ago, and had identical cultures, language, ethnicities, food, and even jokes. Everything was the same, except for the rule of the modernizing Ba'ath party in Syria, compared to the totally benign state in Lebanon. In spite of a civil war that decimated the population, causing an acute brain drain and setting wealth back by several decades, in addition to every possible form of chaos that rocked the place, today Lebanon has a considerably higher standard of living, between 3 and 6 times the wealth of Syria. Nor did the point escape Machiavelli. Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote, citing him, "It seemed," wrote Machiavelli, "that in the midst of murders and civil wars, our republic became stronger and its citizens infused with virtues. A little bit of agitation gives resources to souls, and what makes the species prosper isn't peace, but freedom." Pax Romana. The centralized nation-state is not exactly new in history. In fact, it existed in a nearly identical form in ancient Egypt. But this was an isolated event in history, and it did not survive there for long. The Egyptian high state started collapsing upon contact with the crazy, unruly, barbaric, disorganized, harassing invaders coming from Asia Minor with their assault chariots, literally a killer app. The dynasties of ancient Egypt did not run the place like an empire, but like an integrated state, which is markedly different. As we saw, it produces different types of variations. Nation-states rely on centralized bureaucracy, whereas empires, such as the Roman Empire and Ottoman dynasties, have relied on local elites, in fact allowing the city-states to prosper and conserve some effective autonomy, and, what was great for peace, such autonomy was commercial, not military. In reality, the Ottomans did these vassals and